Hi, and welcome to this week's Expert HR podcast with me, Ellie Gelder. September is almost here, and it's that time of year when the 2016 crop of graduates will be starting their new careers. However, graduating these days comes at a cost. According to the money charity, graduate debt is reaching more than a third of the average mortgage. So given that graduates are facing huge levels of debt, how much can they be expecting to earn in their first jobs, and how does that compare to graduate salaries last year? With me to discuss findings from Expert HR's 27th annual survey on graduate recruitment is benchmarking editor Michael Carty. And staying with the theme of new starters, Senior Employment Law Editor Susie Munro also joins us to discuss the use of probationary periods and runs through some of the most common issues that can arise. So let's start by looking at graduate recruitment then. Michael, what does the latest Expert HR survey have to tell us about the state of the graduate labour market?
Well, at first glance, it would appear to be in rude health. We've seen a strong recovery in the number of employers seeking graduate recruits in 2016, after a slight dip last year.
Sounds positive so far.
Yes, 9 out of 10 employers in our survey are looking to hire graduates this year, or have already done so. And half of employers are upping their graduate intake from last year. But while the overall picture is positive, the outlook for graduate starting salaries isn't quite so optimistic.
In what way?
Well, the trend for freezing graduate starting salaries is ongoing. 2/3 of employers say they've frozen graduate starting salaries this year.
So graduate starting salaries have been frozen for a while now, haven't they?
That's right, yes. As you said, this is Expert HR's 27th annual survey, tracking trends in graduate recruitment. But it's actually the 8th year in a row in which we've recorded a freeze in graduate starting salaries.
So 8 consecutive years of freezes. So the last time that the Expert HR survey showed an increase to graduate starting salaries would have been in 2008, just as the recession took hold.
Exactly, yes.
So why are graduate starting salaries being frozen?
Some respondents are freezing starting salaries for this year in response to economic uncertainty around the EU referendum. Others, meanwhile, mentioned affordability issues. For example, they might already feel that they're at the limit of what they can realistically offer graduates.
So did any employers raise graduate starting salaries?
Around 1 in 3 did, and amongst these, the most common increase is 2%.
So what can new graduates from the class of 2016 expect to earn in their first jobs?
We found that the median graduate starting salary for 2016-2017 is £23,000, and that's actually unchanged from the level we saw a year ago.
So graduate starting salary levels are fairly static then?
For now, yes. But looking back over the past few years, it looks like the traditional salary premium associated with getting a degree is gradually being eroded.
How so?
The longer-term trend for graduate starting salaries actually seems to be edging slowly downwards. The median graduate starting salary is currently stuck at £23,000, but 2 years ago it was a little higher at £23,500, and 3 years ago it was higher still at £24,500. But I must stress that these surveys aren't based on a matched sample.
So which employers are offering graduates the highest starting salaries?
Well, private sector services firms are offering the highest median starting salaries at £24,900. Then, down at the opposite end of the spectrum, the public sector median is just £22,000.
So graduates can generally expect higher starting salaries in the private sector?
That's right, yes. We found that a minority of private sector firms are pitching their graduate starting salaries for 2016 at £29,000 or higher. One finance sector employer went as high as £45,000.
Wow, so £45,000 is a very healthy graduate starting salary. Sounds like some employers are still willing to pay more to secure the best graduate candidates.
Yes, we found other evidence to confirm this too. Just over half of private sector employers are actually going beyond starting salaries and are using additional reward elements to attract the best candidates.
So what sort of additional reward elements are private sector employers using?
The most common option is to offer graduates bonus scheme participation in their first year of employment. And then after that, other popular additional reward elements include things like golden hellos, car allowances, and company cars.
And the Expert HR survey also has data on graduate recruitment approaches, doesn't it? So how are employers seeking out graduates?
Well, we're seeing quite a diverse picture, with employers using a mix of traditional means of reaching graduates and newer online methods. The public sector is really leading the way here. There's been an explosion in social media use for graduate recruitment in the public sector. 3/4 of public sector employers are using social media to attract graduates in 2016, and that's up sharply from around half last year.
And why do you think that public sector employers are turning to social media to find their graduate recruits?
Well, it's likely that cost is the main driver here. Social media is often seen as a much lower cost option for advertising jobs than more traditional methods, like, say, national newspaper advertising. And social media is, of course, also a much more direct route to reaching today's graduates.
So we've looked at who's recruiting graduates, we've looked at how they're finding them and what they're paying them. Does the survey provide any insights on how employers perceive the overall state of graduate recruitment?
Yes, and overall, employers think that they're doing a pretty good job. A huge majority of employers in our survey rate their organisation as either effective or very effective when it comes to recruiting and selecting high-quality graduates.
But it's not all plain sailing for graduate recruitment, I'm sure. Some must have had issues with graduate recruitment.
Yes, indeed. Around 9 in 10 employers say they've experienced problems with graduate recruitment.
So what sort of problems are they seeing?
The most common issue that they bring up is poor quality applicants.
Poor quality in what way?
Well, anecdotally, some respondents told us that they don't think some of today's graduates are necessarily of what might be considered graduate calibre. For example, one complained of graduates with poor basic skills, such as being able to write a covering letter. And then another respondent said that many graduates just aren't job ready, that they tend to have unrealistic expectations of what it's like to be in a working environment.
So besides perceived poor quality candidates, were there any other common graduate recruitment problems?
Well, after that, the next most common problem is a lack of applicants. And this is particularly prevalent, we find, in the public sector, possibly reflecting lower graduate starting salaries there.
And were there any other notable issues with graduate recruitment?
Well, we could be seeing the trend for portfolio careers starting to have an impact on employers' ability to retain graduate recruits.
So portfolio careers, then, that's where people move quite quickly from job to job, building experience across roles or even sectors as they go. How is that affecting graduate recruitment?
Some employers said that they're just not able to hold on to graduate recruits, which means that they're not seeing much return on investment in graduates. One private sector employer told us that new graduates very rarely stay in their first job or even in their second and third jobs for very long. They went on to say that this makes recruiting them a very expensive process when measured against their productivity in the role.
Definitely a trend to watch them.
If employers see less value in recruiting graduates in the first place, we could end up seeing even less room for movement on graduate starting salaries in the next few years.
Thanks, Michael. Where can our listeners find out more?
You can access the complete results data on Expert HR Benchmarking.
Okay, let's move on to probationary periods now then. Susie, does an employer have to use probationary periods?
No, there's no legal framework requiring a probationary period. It's up to individual employers to decide whether or not to have one, and if they do want one, to set out in the contract of the new starter how it will work.
So there's no legal definition of a probationary period, so it's not as if it's a separate employment status with any kind of protection. A probationer doesn't have any more or any fewer statutory employment rights just because they're in their probationary period.
That's right.
So the length of the probationary period is going to depend on what the employer sets out in the contract then?
Yes, so what would be a suitable length will depend on the nature of the job and how long will be necessary to assess whether the employee is suitable. It's really up to the employer. So, for example, 3 months might be standard, but you might want longer for more senior roles.
Okay, and what about notice periods? Are they going to be different for a probationer?
They can be. Because it's all determined by what's in the contract, the employer can decide to have a shorter notice period during the probationary period. And that would allow the employer to dismiss the employee with less notice if it turns out that they're not suitable. But that would obviously be subject to the statutory minimum 1 week's notice after the first month.
So, for example, there could be a 2 week notice period rising to 2 months when the employee completes their probationary period.
Yes.
And the purpose of the probationary period is to give the employer time to assess whether or not that person is suitable for the role.
Yes, and also to provide a structure for the employee to know what's expected of them and to be able to make improvements where necessary. So if they're receiving feedback and guidance from the outset, it's more likely that they're going to do well in the role than if performance issues are just left to escalate and only tackled when they've become serious. So ideally, a probationary period won't just consist of an induction and then a review meeting at the end to tell the employee if they've passed or not. Ideally, you'd want regular meetings to discuss progress, to make sure that the employee knows what standards are required, and also providing positive feedback where things are going well.
So what if an employee still isn't meeting the required standard at the end of their probationary period? What do you do there?
Well, the employer's got the option to extend the probationary period, and that could be if it appears that the employee could make the required improvements with extra training or coaching, or if they've already been given ample opportunity to improve and it's really clear that they're not going to be able to succeed in the role, then the employer can dismiss them.
So in those circumstances, does the employer have to wait until the end of the probationary period before dismissing the employee?
No, being a probationer doesn't give you protection from dismissal before the end of the probationary period. So if it's clear that the employee won't meet the required standards, the employer can dismiss them by giving them the required notice. And in fact, the employer has to be careful with the timing of a dismissal if the contract provides for a shorter notice period during the probationary period. So if the dismissal takes place after the probationary period has expired, the employee will have become entitled to the longer notice period. So the dismissal meeting has to take place before the end of the probationary period.
And presumably a probationary is unlikely to have the 2 years service necessary to claim unfair dismissal, unless of course they've transferred from another part of the organisation and been put on a probationary period in their new role. So can the employer dismiss them without following a fair dismissal procedure?
Well, as always, if someone doesn't have the required service, even though they can't generally claim unfair dismissal, they could still bring a claim for discrimination or unfair dismissal for an automatically unfair reason, like pregnancy or whistleblowing. So it's important for the employer to keep evidence of the poor performance, any support given, and the whole decision-making process so that they can show that there's no reason for the dismissal except the employee's performance.
So following a fair procedure, giving the employee warnings, the chance to improve, that's all going to put the employer in a stronger position.
Yes, but where there's no question of discrimination, whistleblowing, or another automatically unfair reason for dismissal, the employee won't be able to challenge the dismissal, and the fact that they were on probation wouldn't be relevant.
And employers should make sure that they also follow any contractual procedure when dismissing a probationer.
Yes, that's important to avoid a claim for wrongful dismissal, breach of contract, and also obviously they have to give them the contractual notice, which must be no less than the statutory minimum of 1 week if the employee has between 1 month and 2 years service.
Thanks very much, Susie and Michael. If you'd like further information on using probationary periods, have a look at our tasks, which you'll find on the Expert HR homepage, and select Recruitment and then Probationary Periods. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast, which you've been listening to with me, Ellie Gelder. We're back again next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.